You're listening to GNU World Order Season 12, Episode 40, for October 1st, 2018. In this episode, I want to talk about some POSIX tips. I was about to say bash tips, but they're actually POSIX compliant shell tips. It's a really good little article I found online and figured I would share. I also want to take some feedback, listener feedback, which I have some of. So let's get started. Starting out with an email from Deep Geek. I've got a rather lengthy email exchange that I'm not 100% sure I was following at first, but then Deep Geek clarified his position, and now I do follow it. So I'm not sure the best way to follow it all, because it actually all, in my misunderstanding, I feel like that actually rendered some interesting stuff as well. So I'll read bits of Deep Geek's original email. He says, "I feel that it isn't about what the OS can do for you, because if it was, we would have won that battle." So he's talking about the popularity of an operating system, and I was saying how popular web browsers are, and so he's kind of addressing that issue. He says, he continues to say, "Therefore, I believe it is something else, something perhaps irrational. I think it is a matter of cool." C-O-O-L. And he says, "Remember in high school, certain bands were cool and certain bands weren't, and the normal folk never sat down," he didn't say folk, he said, "and the normals never sat down and had a committee or made a list. I think it's like that. I remember listening to Alternative before it was called Alternative," and then he goes on and on. So what he's saying here is that there's, like in high school, you know, there are cool things in high school, right? And it's not as if though the popular kids or the normal people in high school ever got together, sat down around a table and worked out, okay, here's what's popular, here's what's not popular, and so on. It just all surfaced and it became popular. So he says, regarding web browsers, sure, the guys who invented it didn't see it as it being a universal interface. But as it took off, the guys at Microsoft did. They called it the middleware threat. The most important browser now is an Android browser, as many people use that as their primary computer. It's a good point as well. So I think what he's getting at, and what I responded with, was more or less that I think he was saying, or what I thought he was saying, is that popular tech equals the best marketed tech. And whether or not that encapsulate what he is saying, there is this Illuminati factor, for lack of a better term. And yes, I'm using Illuminati sarcastically, but you know, there's that sort of thing that you can't quite put your finger on. And I guess like many people, I'm forever searching for what that is. And the example I gave him was volume knobs on TV sets. TV sets, if you remember, or if you've ever seen photographs of them, old TV sets used to be, well, a lot bigger than they are now, first of all, but they also happened to have knobs, physical knobs on the front of the TV set. And in order to change a channel, for instance, you would have to go, you'd stand up and you would turn this knob. And the knob had preset numbers of channels in them, you know, and I don't know how high it went. I don't really know, but I'm assuming, you know, some set number of channels that would reasonably represent the TV signals you could pick up on your TV antenna, because that's how it was done for a very long time. There was no cable television. It was all just over-the-air TV signals. So that made sense. That kind of stopped making sense after a while, because at some point, those knobs just couldn't contain all of the feasible channels out there. And it somehow got reduced to, I think traditionally, it was channel 3. You would put it on channel 3. I don't know why they chose 3. And maybe that was just the region I was in. But you put it on channel 3, and then you could, that would tell your television screen to look somewhere else for a signal. So it wouldn't be looking at the antenna, it would be looking for like the auxiliary input or something, the coax input, whatever. And you could plug your VCR into it, or your DVD player, or I guess probably a cable, you know, and then you could get TV on that, or you could get a signal on that screen from some other source, in other words. And again, I have no idea if it's 3 all over America, or if that was just in whatever region I was in at the time. I don't remember, I would have been a kid. But there's that, right? So that that knob was there and it disappeared and it kind of had to go because it stopped being useful. It was like, well, we got 24 channels on this knob. We can't fit any more on there. It's stupid. We have 256 stations out there. So they got rid of that. That's fine. That makes sense. But there was this other knob for volume. And if you turned it all the way one way, you'd have no sound. And if you turned it progressively clockwise, then you'd have sound at varying levels, or at a progressively incrementing level. And it worked really well. You could really get precise volume out of that. It was there when you needed it. It was always there. It was always accessible. And at some point, somewhere in the industry, someone decided, we don't need those knobs anymore. We're going to use analog push buttons or no knob at all, no button at all, and we're just going to relegate it to the remote control. And the problem with that, of course, bemoaned by many people for many decades now, has been that if you can't find your remote, then you cannot adjust your TV, or you can't adjust your TV as easily or as quickly, whatever the case may be. And it was just one of those things where those knobs really made sense. They were actually really, really functional. They were fluid. They were fast. They were micro-adjustable. It was a great system. And why did the volume knob, of all things, go away? I understand the channel knob, but the volume knob just seemed, it was superior technology. And you might think, well, yeah, but then you can't adjust it from far away. Well, yeah, you can. They solved that problem a long time ago. You can have a knob whose position is relative, but still have the remote control that adjusts the volume independently of the physical knob. So you can have both things. It's just why switch to these push buttons, these digital push buttons? So how did that decision get made is what I'm saying. Like, that was a lot of history of television sets for a very small question, which is, how do those random weird decisions come about, and why do they take hold? I mean, I'm assuming that all the TV manufacturers didn't get together and say, hey, we should take all the knobs off of TVs. That would be really cool. And we'll just put buttons. Or similarly, and this I have a little bit more insight on because I guess I was more aware of what was going on at the time, but I mean, compared to TV, the laptops, right? So Apple came out with those stupid touchpads on their laptops with no buttons. There were no buttons on their touchpads, and then you could get like all your fingers on the touchpad and do different things with the touchpad. And it was, I guess, supposed to be really cool because you could do so much with your fingers, and you could push the touchpad, and you had no buttons. And the moment I tried it, I thought, this is the stupidest technology I've ever seen in my life. I mean, the multi-touch is okay. That's fine. Like, three fingers on the pad does one thing, two on the, you know, that's whatever. But the lack of a button just seems completely stupid. Why is that a thing? But it became super popular. Like, you're hard pressed nowadays to find a laptop on the shelf with the correct number of buttons on the touchpad. I mean, you can find high-end laptops that still have some sense left to them with actual buttons, but it made its way into popular thinking of touchpads, or popular design of touchpads. Oh, we're not going to have buttons now. We're just going to have a big slab that you have to press down, or you don't press at all. It's just, it senses your finger and it kind of knows whether that's a press or not. Cell phones, they used to have keyboards. Maybe they weren't big keyboards. Maybe they weren't great keyboards. There were some that were pretty good. They slid out from under the cell phone main body and you could type on it. Others just kind of had them really tiny little keyboards at the bottom of the phone, whatever. For whatever reason, someone thought that was a stupid idea and got rid of the keyboards. And then everyone got rid of the keyboards. And I still don't understand the point of that. I have a cell phone for work, and it is like all the other phones out right now, that there's no keyboard on there. And so, you know, you're sitting there trying to read something on the screen, or you're just holding it, and you've got basically no space. Like, anywhere you put your hand is activating some kind of touch response. So, you know, no matter how you hold the thing, something's happening. And all you actually are trying to do is hold the phone in your hand. So you end up kind of cradling it in this weird sort of unnaturally sort of sacred way. You cradle it in your hand so that your fingers don't touch the front of the screen, but you're still actually holding onto the screen so it doesn't tumble out of your hand. It's the most annoying thing, but it became popular. So what I'm trying to always get to, I guess, is how does that stuff get popular? How does that happen? How do people get swept away by these really stupid ideas and then get convinced that they are, in fact, just the only way to go? Like, if it doesn't have that feature, horrible though it may be, then it's not worth owning. Now, Deep Geek responded to me and says it's a little different. What I'm saying is that normals or pinks or units, whatever you want to call them, aren't making tech decisions at all. That instead they are doing some herding instinct that we call fashion. I don't think they can actually push a fashion. I think companies can hire people who know what is fashionable. So don't try to talk logically to these people. It's like talking to a dog about algebra. Just rest assured that someday a teenager will say to another, "Oh yeah, the iPhone. Everybody's dad liked the iPhone." So he's saying, in other words, everything in time will fall out of fashion, and that fashion, when it's current, is, I guess he's saying it's inexplicable. It's unobtainable. It's esoteric. I mean, and that is an argument. I am looking for an Illuminati kind of conspiracy source of all of this stuff that rises from the subconsciousness, collective consciousness, I guess, of people. But I figure the way I see it personally is that someone's got to make that call at some point. But maybe that's just the structure of things. You know, if someone makes that call and that someone is up at the top of a company, then that trickles down into the rest of the company. And then it becomes a thing within that company. I mean, that's it. And people just have to, you know, initially people are paid to like that idea. They just think, or they don't even have to like it, but they're paid to implement it. And so it gets implemented and then it gets pushed out into the culture. And if the culture says that is a thing that we believe is cool, then it becomes cool. I guess maybe that's what it is. I don't know. It's a complex issue, and it's kind of annoying to me that it can't be solved within 10 minutes of podcasting, but I guess we can keep working at it. All of that was in response, I believe. I mean, he didn't exactly reference like the episode number and the topic or whatever, but I think that was all in response to me saying that people are using the web browser as the big universal interface, and how I was thinking that was curious to me that had made such an impact on computing, on computerists of the modern age, that became the thing that everyone could understand and latch onto and go with, really. And I was wondering why, and I'm wondering what kind of hook we can use to appeal to people in other ways. And of course, when I say we and appeal to people, I'm not saying we as like the Linux company, because we're not a Linux company, we're just a bunch of people who happen to like open source. I'm saying we as in people who are active in the computer community. What can we do to make people's experience better, but also enable them to go further than they expect because it is open source? And I guess that's just an ongoing question for each of us, really. I mean, that's what it boils down to, at least at this stage. But I do think there's value to that. And it could be hopeful, it could be wishful thinking, you know, the whole, like, one person can make a big difference, that sort of thing. I don't know if I'm really saying that, but I mean, certainly when I'm doing things and I catch myself doing something, maybe it's a bit much of a hack. It's a hack, but maybe it's a hack too far. Then sometimes I try to reel myself in and think, okay, well, I should really do this properly. Like, it might take me longer to do it, but I'm going to do it properly. And that way I can post it online. And if someone else finds it, then hey, great for them. They've found something that's worthwhile. And if no one finds it, that's okay. At least I've gone to the trouble of making something complete. Or when I find a bug in something, sometimes I just fix it for myself and move on. Other times I think, you know what, I should at least submit this thing. I should at least register this as something that caused me to stumble in this process. And sometimes it's pretty difficult to find the place to report it to, which, I mean, is a bug in itself, right? That project ought to make that more available. But I don't know. It's just, it's always thinking about how the quote-unquote customer really, really matters, and that we're serving the quote-unquote customer, and that the quote-unquote customer is each one of us. Now, isn't that a charming and capitalistic view of society? We're all each other's customers. Take it or leave it. Point being, as computerists, we're helping each other. We're serving each other in different ways. And I think the more that we can do to actually improve each other's process or code or whatever it may be, then that's great. I think that's part of the process of building something better. Now, whether or not that's enough to, you know, topple the institutions of evil software and evil technology, you know, I don't know. It's probably not going to do it. But if you're looking for that one small thing that you can do each day to improve things, I think that's worth thinking about. What can I do to do things correctly and make this an appealing way to get something done? I think that's something to think about. The next bit of feedback I got was not actually feedback. It's a retroactive credit. I knew, and I think I even said in the episode about Lutris, that I'd heard about it from someone on some social network, I think is what I said, or someone somewhere, I don't know. But it turns out the person that I heard it from is named Nige, N-I-G-E, or I don't know if that's his name, but that's the person's handle on Mastodon, or username, whatever you call it on Mastodon. It's their handle on Mastodon. And I knew that I'd heard of it from someone on Mastodon, but Mastodon doesn't have a great search feature, or at least not a great easy search feature. I haven't quite figured it out. Like, if I want to go to all of the posts that I've made on Mastodon and search for a string, how do I do that? I'm not sure. I have not figured that one out yet. I mean, I imagine I could download my history and then grep through the history, but I'm not going to do that for every time I find out something from someone on Mastodon, and then, you know, that's crazy. But Nige kindly said that it wasn't a big deal that I didn't give any credit for having heard about Lutris from Nige. But Nige did write a blog post about Lutris and how it works on Guild Wars 2, I think is what the game is. It's Guild Wars 2, GW2. I don't know what Guild Wars 2 is. I'm assuming it's kind of like an MMO or something. I've never played it. Nige has. And yeah, Nige has a pretty good little blog post on it. It's a quick one. It's not really a subjective blog. I mean, it's how to get Lutris up and running and how to get Guild Wars working on it. So it's a good little post, possibly just to show what you have to do in order to get something to possibly work on Lutris. Which, I mean, that's not to say that Lutris, I mean, the important thing to know about Lutris is, and I feel like I tried to make this clear in my episode, but I might as well mention it again, and that is that it isn't anything more than an aggregator. It's a library. It is a thing to manage your library. So it doesn't do anything special, really. And even its install scripts, if you look at a couple of install scripts, you'll get a feeling for just how simple they are. They're really, really, it's almost like you shouldn't call them install scripts. It's really just kind of, it's a couple of variables for Lutris to reference when it displays what you have told it your library is. So you may, you know, and this confused me initially, and that's why I kind of want to bring it up again. You might open Lutris and try to, you can add a game that already is installed on your hard drive, and that's pretty simple, because all you're doing is pointing it at an executable and saying, that's where the game is, add it to my library, and I'll give it a little icon, and then we're good to go. And that's easy, and that's kind of it's almost a non-manual, you know, it's almost a wizard for making a .desktop file, in a way, except that it's not a .desktop file, it's a Lutris launcher icon. Now, if you open Lutris and then use it to quote-unquote install something, then you're not really using Lutris to install something. And I think that's where I kind of got really, that when I was spending time with it, really caused me to hesitate when I saw that it would install things, because I thought, well, how is it installing things? What is it installing? I don't understand. And it would ask me for something like, show me the Humble Bundle archive that you downloaded, or the GOG.com, zip file that you, or the zip file that you downloaded from GOG.com or whatever. So there would be these, you know, and you would point it to that, and then something would happen in the background, and you're not really sure what, and then in the end, maybe you have a working game. And what was happening, at least in many of those cases, was that it was circumventing the install scripts, which were usually very simple install scripts anyway, that consisted of unzip this code, you know, all this game package, unzip it into the place where the user said that their destination was. I mean, these installers are not rocket science by any means. It's usually, show me where you want me to put all your games, and you do that, and then it makes a subdirectory for the game, puts all the game files in it. Maybe it generates a .desktop file and spits it out somewhere for you, maybe on your desktop, and that's it. So Lutris is really just leveraging installers that already exist. And all that it actually does when you're saying, okay, install this game, in many, many cases, is it's launching an install process or circumventing an install process and just unarchiving something that already exists into the location that you've told it that you want things to go to. And then it's making a little YAML entry or a JSON entry, I forget which, into its own configuration file so that when you launch Lutris in the future, then that game will always be there. And it will know where to find the corresponding executable and the little icon that you click to start it and so on. So Lutris is not anything magical. It's just something magically contained. And that is, I think, for me, that's its biggest selling point, is that everything in, or not everything, but many things in Lutris kind of, they get sandboxed, as it were, not from a security standpoint or anything, just from a convenience standpoint. They all get placed in the .local/share/Lutris folder, or the .config/Lutris folder, and so everything kind of, you keep everything self-contained. Not your games, but the stuff about Lutris itself all sort of happens within Lutris, and all the little emulators that you need to run certain games, they get put into this Lutris place, and so it removes a lot of the assembly from you, and that's kind of the feature of Lutris. And I think that Nige's blog post about Guild Wars 2 kind of reinforces that, meaning that you might know that, okay, well, I need wine to run this Guild Wars game, and Guild Wars exists in my /games to make sure that the wine is the correct, you know, 64-bit wine so that it will run this game that I got. And so you kind of need to know what you're dealing with. And then in some cases, you know, wine is kind of it's a big, vast thing that, you know, if a game might come out that you need an extra DLL file to run, so, and Wine doesn't know that because Wine's just emulating what it's emulating, or not emulating, it's, Wine is not an emulator. Wine has the DLL files that it's got, and that's what it's got. It's not like, you know, so if you download Guild Wars 2 and it ships with certain DLLs and Wine's got its DLLs, but there's yet another DLL out there that you need, there's nobody telling your combination of Wine and Guild Wars 2 that, hey, you need yet another third-party DLL in order for this other thing to run. You know, there's no sense of, there's no management. There's no package management there. And certainly, why would there be? I mean, Guild Wars 2 doesn't know that you're installing it on Linux, and Guild Wars 2 expects, I guess, that if you're installing it on Windows, certain things exist. I don't really know how all that stuff works because I've never really used Windows, but it's a good blog post if you want to get kind of a behind the scenes look at what you may have to do to get something running that's a little bit of an edge case. Read it up. Read this thing and see what Nige had to do to get everything running, because it is, I don't know, I like reading about this sort of thing, like the stuff that people have to go through in order to get something to work, whether it's an application or a game or a programming, you know, an API or a trick in programming, something that they figured out. I just like reading that sort of thing. So I'll put a link to that blog post in the show notes. And now it is time for coffee. Don't you agree? Thought you would. Thank you. Okay, you've got coffee. I've got coffee. You've got a POSIX compliant shell. I've got a POSIX compliant shell. So there's this great blog post that I stumbled across. I think, strangely, I think someone on Mastodon. Oh yeah, Tomasino on Mastodon posted it, and I couldn't resist because the name of the blog post was Insufficiently Known POSIX Shell Tricks or Features. And I thought, well, that's great because people should know more about their shell features. And these are POSIX compliant. So that means that it's these are not bashisms. These are not C-shellisms. These are not cornisms. Is that a term? These are just, if your shell is POSIX compliant, it can do these things. POSIX being, of course, the set of specifications that are the set of standards, I guess you could even say, that define, well, anything that claims to be POSIX, really. And things that claim to be POSIX compliant include, or mostly POSIX compliant, include Linux, BSD, macOS, and Windows, believe it or not. So, yeah, you've got something like, let's say you've got source, SRC, all capitals. I mean, it doesn't have to be, but let's just say it is. Equals path to foo.c. So we've just set a variable, right? This is in a bash shell, for instance. So if I do an echo $ source, then I get path to foo.c. Now, of course, that example in itself includes a bashism. So I'm going to switch over to tcsh, and I'm going to do this the tcsh way, and I'm going to do set source, set space, source space, and then slash path to foo.c. Oh, no. There we go. So now I've got set space source equals slash path slash to slash foo.c. And so then if I do an echo $SRC, I have path to c. So I've got both in bash and tcsh, that's how you would do it. It's just the difference is in tcsh, you have to do set space, and then the variable equals the value. And in bash, you can just do variable name equals, and then the value. Okay, so that was obviously neither here nor there in relation to what we're talking about. But I just wanted to highlight that in the example in the blog, he uses a method of setting a variable that may or may not work on a specific shell, depending on what you're using. So, which, I mean, I don't blame him. I wouldn't try to provide every single way of doing a thing in every single shell either. But then, so the point being is that we've got this thing, right? We got path to, and then this value, foo.c. What if you also needed to reference path to foo.o? So in this example, he's got obj as an object. Obj equals $brace src percent sign, that's the important part, dot c, and then close brace, dot o. So now if I do an echo $ obj, I've got path to foo dot o. So that's huge. It's huge because if you think about, I mean, I know that personally I do this all the time because I'm very frequently converting from one thing to another, whether it's an audio file down to something else, or whether it's a text file from one thing to another, or image files. It seems like I'm converting things all the time, and usually in bulk. It's usually not just a one-off thing. And even if it is a one-off thing, it can get quite tedious to try to figure out, well, how do I get just the extension part of a file? And you can do things like, you know, if we do, like, let's just do echo foo.c. Okay, that obviously foo.c is echoed back. Okay, so then if I pipe that to, let's do a pipe it to rev. Okay, so that reverses it. C.oof. Okay, that's good. So now let's do a pipe to foo.c pipe rev pipe cut dash field one delimited by a dot. Now I've got c. Okay, so I've successfully chopped off just the extension. So that's good. So now what do I do? Well, I don't know. Okay, well, what if we do base name foo.c. I get foo.c. So what if I do, I think there's some kind of argument to base name where we can just get the suffix, yeah. So base name dash dash suffix equals .c, I think is what we can do. Then I forgot to provide the path to the thing that I wanted the base name of. And then I get foo.c. So that could work. So base name dash dash suffix dot C. So if I can get the C from one thing and then put that into the argument of the base name, then I can get just foo, and then I could append the desired suffix to that base. So that would be something like base name dash dash suffix equals, and then I would do maybe a backtick, and I would do an echo, you know, foo.c or whatever it is, like whatever variable, and then pipe that to rev, and then pipe that to cut dash f1 dash delta or dash d quote.c quote, or maybe just dot quote, and then close backtick, and then path to foo.c, and then all of that would have to be in something, and then I would append the desired suffix to it, so it would be dot, you know, oh. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare, right? I mean, I've just stepped through it for you, and it's a nightmare. This is much, much easier, being able to say, okay, here's a new variable equal to $brace src percent dot c dot o. Oh, and you might think, well, yeah, but we could just do, we could assume that we know the extension, and we could just do obj equals $ parentheses base name $ source space dot c parentheses dot o. That would work, but that also strips the path. Base name doesn't preserve the whole path. It's the base name. So it's a pretty handy tip, and he kind of throws in another one in there, but I think both of them kind of rely on some basic understanding of the $brace notation, which you can read about on gnu.org/software/bash/manual. And if you look around in there, there's a section 3.5.3 about shell parameter expansion, and it differentiates between, or rather it clarifies what the braces are actually doing. Long story short, it's kind of an array. So for instance, if you've ever done anything in Python where you're looking at a string as an array of characters, it's kind of similar to that, although not necessarily. If you really want the details, go read this thing, because it goes into details about it. But I think of it as, in terms a little bit of like the Python example, where instead of, you know, if you have something in this string like foo, then don't see it as a string, see it as an array of characters. So you have FOO actually. And in a way, the $brace kind of looks at it in the same way. So if you provide, for instance, if you do an echo $brace source, I think was the original one, right? SRC close brace, then you get the path to foo.c, which isn't a big deal. But let's say that we had var equals, and then I'll do quotes, hello space world, close quote, and then I do echo $var, I get hello space world. Now, in some commands, that could be a problem because there's a space in there. And as you know, a shell sees a space, a raw space, as a separation. That means that, you know, that's how it delineates a command from an argument, or a command from an option from an argument. So if you have a space in your argument, that can throw things off. And so if you put that within $brace, so you do echo $brace var close brace, then, I mean, it looks the same to you. It's still hello space world. But the command that you are running that variable in, it won't see that space. It will just see var, if that makes any sense. It might not make a whole lot of sense, but that's kind of one way to see it. But here's another way of seeing it, which is, well, the way that you've already seen it, which is the source percent sign dot C close brace dot O. So that percent did something, right? It did something to the variable, to the stuff contained in that variable. And there are other things that you can do to variables. So if you do an echo space $brace src hash asterisk and then a slash, like the same kind of slash that you would use to separate, you know, path slash to slash foo.c, you do that and you get just not slash path slash to slash foo.c, but just path slash to path foo.c. So it took out the first field delineated by a slash. So if you do echo sort $brace source hash hash asterisk slash close brace, then you just get foo.c. So it's a shortened version of base name, really, is what that is. Hash hash asterisk slash. So that was kind of cool. So that was one tip from this person's blog. The next one was default values for variables. And this one is a really handy one that I use all the time, actually, in Slack builds. So if I go up to my Slack build tree, if I can find it on this computer, yep, user local Slack builds. And then I'll just go into any random one. So we can go into maybe audio, aj-snapshot, and then I'll do a head-in33 for aj/snapshot.slackbuild. So there are things like version equals, $brace, --, that's like a minus sign, a dash, 0.9.6, close brace. Now what that means is that the version, the variable called version, is set to 0.9.6 if no other value is provided. Here's another example, actually. This might even be better. Output equals $brace output --/temp, close brace. So if I wanted to, for instance, run a Slack build, but I wanted it to output to some other place than /tmp, then I could just put out, I could type output equals, I don't know, /home/clatu/code, space, and then I could run the Slack build, like /aj-snapshot.slackbuild. And that Slack build would then read the output variable not as /tmp, but as whatever I entered as an argument in my immediate environment. So in other words, this notation of --, within the $braces, that provides the default value of a variable if nothing else overrides it. But wait, there's more, and this I didn't realize, or I never knew this until this blog post, but apparently the dash notation in that example doesn't actually change the variable. It's a one-shot substitution. Now, what exactly that means pragmatically, I have not really experienced yet, but because when I run Slack builds and I know in my head that, hey, I know that the, let's say the tag is _SBO as all the Slack builds that you create are tagged with SBO from slackbuilds.org rather, but maybe I've changed it a significant amount and I know that instead of using the default tag, I should really tag this with my own SMI, slackermedia.info SMI tag. So maybe if I'm running a Slack build, I'll just tag --SMI and then name of the, you know, execute the Slack build and it's off and running. Now, okay, so technically, apparently that doesn't change the tag value. Actually, that was probably a really bad example because I think tag literally is only invoked once. Doesn't really matter. Point is that that's now my environment variable. So I have set an external variable that my Slack build is referencing upon launch. So I don't really know if the fact that the Slack builds use a --, actually matters one way or the other. The blog author here, though, is specifically recommending --equals. So, for instance, $CC:GCC(+). is a way to set throughout one file and then all other files invoked by that file. So, for instance, in a series of makefiles, CC is set to GCC by default. And that seems rather significant in a complex workflow. So that's --equals for the default variable settings. Now the blog article has a lot more tips, and some of them I agree with, some of them I didn't really love. I mean, not that they were wrong, because I mean, he gives proof of concept and everything in the blog post. It's a really well-written blog post. Just some of them I looked at and I thought, well, yes, that's possible, but it kind of, you know, I think sometimes it's better to do something maybe a different way that maybe it's a little bit longer, maybe it's a little bit more complex, but it's just the right way. The easy example that I'm thinking of is where he says that you don't have to use quotes at certain times in variable things. And like, that's great. That's cool that you don't have to do that. But I don't know. I struggle to get myself to use quotes more often. And so I don't need encouragement to like not use quotes sometimes because, hey, it works. Meh, you know, I'll stick with the sort of forcing my way for best practices. But another one that he did mention, which I don't think it's as exciting as the other two that I've just talked about, but it's worth mentioning, I think, because it is, it's worth mentioning. So it's in Bash, at least, it's a built-in, I guess, function or whatever they call them, a built-in command in Bash. It is eval. So in other words, if you do a man eval, you, on most systems, or at least on Slackware, you get the TCL script eval or something like that. That's not the eval that I'm talking about or that he's talking about. It's this shell built-in command called eval. And you can look at it. You can do like a man bash and then do a search for eval space, for instance. And that, that gets you there eventually. And it says, eval, and then the argument. The args are read and concatenated together into a single command. This command is then read and executed by the shell, and its exit status is returned as the value of eval. If there are no args or only null arguments, eval returns zero. So that doesn't really tell you much, but what you can do is, well, you can try, for instance, so we've got this src source variable, and if you do an eval space $source, you get bash path to foo.c, no such file or directory. Well, that's true. So basically, it kind of, if you think about it, it kind of exploded that variable. Admittedly, that's not a whole lot different than just typing $src at your bash prompt, but it can be kind of extended into something else. So if you need to assign a variable to another variable, you can do that with eval. So eval space var equals, and then he recommends doing a backslash $src. I found that was not actually necessary, but I'm gonna go with him since his point is escaping bashisms and going for pure POSIX. So I'm gonna assume that he's advising better POSIXness than bash, and that's fine. Well, I'm okay with that. So echo space $var used to say foo, or whatever it said, it now says slash path to foo.c. So it is, the contents of var is now what were the contents of $src. And for kicks, I'm going to try that in the tcsh shell that I have open. So I'm going to do set, no, I guess I can't do that. I'm going to have to do eval set space var equals, and then I'm going to do that backslash src, and then I'm going to do an echo var. And sure enough, that gave me slash path to foo. And I could do test var equals blah, and then I'll run that same eval command just to make sure that we weren't getting false positives here. Yeah, path to foo.c. So that worked as expected. So that's a really great little blog post. It's really useful. apenwarr.ca/log/20110228. So it's an old post, but it is a quite a good post. Like I say, there are a lot more than what I've just covered, but it's the ones that I kind of hooked onto are the ones that I've just mentioned. That's everything for this episode, I think. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Listening to the GNU World Order Ogcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network usually in channels such as Ogcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation, .org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, GNUWorldOrder.info and SlackerMedia.info. I will see you next time.
The name on the back of this tag is Boots.